I hope some of you did get a sense of sitting in the presence of the Buddha. I imagine there'll be a range of responses. Perhaps some people not quite sure what I'm talking about, and some people having very strong experience. Of course, what we're doing when we're talking in terms of sitting in the presence of the Buddha, well, we're speaking a metaphorical, imaginative language. And it's a language that's always in the present, if you see what I mean. You're sitting in the presence of the Buddha now. When we think of the Buddha, we think of him, if you like, as alive now. But from a historical point of view, of course, the Buddha is dead. He entered parinirvana. When we start thinking from that historical, literal, factual point of view, it becomes much more difficult to really relate to and understand who the Buddha is, or was, or something like that. Not quite sure what the tense is that we should use. Because he made it very clear that there's no way we can understand what has happened to him after he enters parinirvana. The Buddha's death passes him beyond our understanding completely. We can't think of him, he says, as existing. We can't think of him as not existing, etc., etc., etc. So all the categories by which we parse our experience, by which we interpret our experience, cannot get at the Buddha post-mortem. And when we're doing an imaginative exercise, the Buddha comes present, and that's not a problem, except for the most literal-minded, which is probably all of us in our worst moments. So when we're able to allow ourselves to imagine, we do feel ourselves in the presence of the Buddha, and that there's probably no complicated debate within ourselves about who he is or where he is or what's happened to him or whatever. But as soon as we start to enter the world of phenomenal experience, everyday experience, what's happened to the Buddha becomes a problem. And if we talk about the Buddha as a goal, it becomes more problematic for us, because the Buddha is the denial of everything by which we know and experience, if you see what I mean. There's a complete denial of the world of appearance. He's voided that. What on earth does that mean? I'll try to explore that over the next 3 days in the rambles, I think. I haven't completely decided, but I think that's the direction that things are going. I'll try to approach that over the next few days a little bit more, as it were, philosophically or theoretically. No, not theoretically, reflectively. Today, I want more to focus on what the goal is for us now. It's very, very difficult to really have the Buddha as a goal, because it means everything that we are, everything that we know, everything we identify with, gone. The Buddha is not reborn. He doesn't enter phenomenal appearance, the phenomenal world at all. At the same time, he's not a non-existent from the point of view of the phenomenal world. More of this tomorrow. So how can we relate to a goal that is sufficiently within our experience for us to relate to it and have some thinking, feeling about it, but that at the same time transcends us as we now are? And of course, for Buddhism, at least in its Mahayana form, perhaps arguably the Theravada form too, in a slightly different way, the Bodhisattva is the goal conceived of from our side, if you see what I mean. Even when we think of the Buddha as a living being. We're sort of thinking of him as really under the heading of Bodhisattva. Sometimes it's said that this could be represented as the Buddha is seated and the Bodhisattva is standing, active within the world. And for us, because we are in the world, if we want a goal which is closer to us and can be related to in terms of our everyday experience, we need to think in terms of the Bodhisattva, one who has let go of self, who's let go of the notion, the delusion of a separate, distinct, permanent self-identity, and indeed let go of the notion of a fixed, independent world out there, and who is animated by, is inspired by motivations that arise without self, selfless motivations, motivations that do not circle back to I, if you see what I mean, as most of our actions do, however good, they circle back to I. Even my metta is sort of based on my love of myself, which is great, it's fine, better than the other thing. I identify with you and I love you because I love myself. It sort of comes back to me. But the Bodhisattva, that doesn't happen. Or the more Bodhisattvic, the less it happens. So that the Maitri flows spontaneously, independent of self. And it seems to me that's important for us to envisage and imagine, because it is so hard for us really to imagine what the Buddha is. Well, Bhante said once that the Buddha, or the Buddhas, are the point on the horizon. I've messed it up, haven't I? But anyway, they're on the horizon. Over the horizon, we don't know. We can't tell. We've got no language for it. They're the point when they just disappear beyond our ken. But the Bodhisattva is squarely on this side. Yes, a long way towards the horizon, but still identifiable in terms of our own experience, although at the same time, quite different from us, in a way that we can perhaps at least understand, because we experience degrees of selflessness and selfishness. So if we can imagine those degrees then changed into not just a difference of degree, but a difference of kind, where there is no self-reference, we've got a little bit of a way of relating to the Bodhisattva. Bhante, part of his genius, I think, is this emphasis on what he calls intermediaries. The goal itself is by definition beyond our ken. It's important for us to recognise that. Otherwise, we reduce everything to our ken, and that is pretty dull and flat. But we do need something within our understanding that moves beyond our understanding, if you see what I mean. So that this is what Bhante calls the transcendental object, something within our experience that points beyond our experience. And as a goal, that, I believe, is what the Bodhisattva represents. But, so I understand our Dhamma life, our practice of the Dhamma, commitment to the Dhamma, our being mitras and order members, as trying to enter into the spirit of the Bodhisattva. That's the way I understand it. That we're trying to participate in the Bodhisattva. Well, Bhante even says, participate in the Bodhisattva. We can't become a Bodhisattva because that means we're sort of appropriating Bodhisattvahood. Bodhisattvahood can only come when we stop being an independent, separate self. But we need that, something we can understand, a being operating within the world, but on a different basis. It's a bodhicitta, a citta, a mind, that is based on bodhi, on illumination, on an awakening. And that awakening is awakening more and more and more until it passes beyond our understanding at Buddhahood. But of course, I can't spend the day focusing on that in the largest in the larger way. What I want to do today is focus on one aspect of how we reach the Bodhisattva goal. And what I've been inspired by is walking through London with Jnanavacha last night, just as people were going out clubbing. And it was really zombie land out there. Very interesting. Each year I come for some reason at this time, and I always go out with Jnanavacha at that time. I hate to think why. But every year the mode of expression of Halloween changes. Anyway, this year it was zombies. People with scars and sewn up faces and weird masks and things like that. Not so many witches. Witches are passé, it seems. I mean, it's very amusing, and sometimes people do it so well, really stylishly done. You know, witches with slip dresses up to here. It's lovely. People with bolts through their necks and all sorts of things. It's wonderful. So imaginative. I don't know how you dance like that, but that's another problem. But the tubes were absolutely jammed with zombies. Unfortunately, they were still quite fresh zombies. I imagine at 4 o'clock in the morning they would have been much more zomboid. Inevitably, in it being an obsessive searcher for meaning, I was reflecting on all this through the night and thinking this is a very interesting cultural phenomenon, isn't it? In the last few years, the Halloween has become, of course, a huge commercial thing. But it can never be just commercial. The commercial things are never just commercial. And as a child in England, Halloween was hardly known. I only knew about it because we had very close friends from Ireland, and they celebrated it. But it seems to have gone from Ireland to America and then come to England that way. And it's just grown over my life. It used to be just for children. Now it's for very large children. And there's a whole upsurge, isn't there, of interest in zombies. I believe there's a whole television programme about it. Is it called The Walking Dead? Is it something like that? And I saw a wonderful New Zealand film about zombie sheep. I do highly recommend it, called Bad Sheep, which is a wonderful film, especially if you've got New Zealand connections. My mother was a New Zealander. A very understated New Zealand humour, where the horror was way over the top and the comedy is very understated. Brilliant film. A bit like Shaun of the Dead. Anyway, I've come off this. It's really interesting as a cultural phenomenon, isn't it, that death has a place, a way for people to relate to it, albeit in an ironic and even comedic way. But death as a phenomenon has a place in cultural representation in this way, as it does, for instance, for my gypsy friends. They're off today in the graveyards, they have very definite rituals. The whole family will come together, they'll go there, they'll have a meal, they'll light candles, flowers, etc. It's very, very important for them to be in connection with their dead. And, that doesn't tend to happen, certainly in white English culture, middle class culture at least. But it's sort of coming in different ways that in this sort of ironic way that it's very dark. It's all to do with skeletons, with all in the colour of night. It's with you know, wounds and reanimated corpses and witches. We saw a troop of gay witches last night. That was about the only one we saw, really, wasn't it? I was told they were gay. I didn't know. I presume that the function that this has is to make sure that we have some relationship to death, the great death, which is the denier of life, if you see what I mean. It has to be represented somewhere. It will come out. And it generally comes out in modern culture, in horror movies, and in this ironic and, in a way, very imaginative and even creative ritual of dressing up as death. I saw a few buccaneers. I don't know what they had to do with it, but no doubt I haven't seen the film. I think it's a really good thing, in a way, that there is a zombie night. I sort of applaud the creativity with which people did dress themselves up. I hope some of you did. Nobody's owning up. And I did ask Nyanavacha if we had a celebration here at the centre where everybody could come as a zombie, but apparently you don't. But yes, not conscious. not trying to be a zombie, but just being one. I thought, therefore, I'd make this my theme of the day: death. But death in the specific sense of what Bhante calls spiritual death. I prefer to call it dhammic death, because the word spiritual has complex resonances, certainly in the West, and in India it has very strong Hindu connotations, adhatmik, which is the translation. But never mind, I'll use spiritual death, because that's how Bhante usually talks of it. Spiritual death, of course, is the acceptance, the full acceptance of death into your life, if you see what I mean. Death, but not death simply as a fact at the end of your life, but as death as something present within your life, moment by moment. Because death is not merely the death of the body, death is the death of the identity, of the self. Whatever happens after death, certainly in Buddhist belief, and I'm personally convinced by this, I will cease. Subhuti will cease. I believe something will follow, and I even believe that will follow in another life. But it won't be Subhuti. Thank goodness. But it'll be affected by Subhuti, poor thing. But it won't be Subhuti. You know, I know I'm affected by past lives. I have some sense of this. But I don't know who it was who went and affected me. It's ridiculous to say that I lived before, because I didn't. You only live once. But your one life is conditioned by a previous and conditions another. That's the Buddhist position. So it's the loss of identity, this sense that I am something unique, enduring, even in a sense permanent. Death is the denier of the permanence of my selfhood, which is why it's so difficult to encompass and let into your life, and why I think we have to dress up as zombies and go clubbing. If you see what I mean, it's a way of coming to terms with, or at least coming into relationship with, the fact of death, which is not only death in the future, it's death in the presence, in the present. Because if I die in the future, my present is related to that death, if you see what I mean. I don't know whether you've experienced this, people who've been given the sentence of death, who've been told that they've got months to live. But a very good friend, somebody who actually was very strongly involved with the building of Sukhavati, Punya. He did a lot of the treating of the dry rot, so you have a lot to thank him for. But Punya died a few years ago. He went to America and he died there. And I saw him just a few months before he died. And he told me that he for the first time felt fully alive. He for the first time was living now. And he said that you cannot imagine how bright everything is, how wonderful everything is. And every day I get up with joy. And if only I'd known this before. Because we live hanging on to something. And that something is denied by death. And if we really can accept that, then we can live fully now. And when we do die, we can die joyously and welcome whatever it is that follows. So spiritual death is taking death into life in the most minute sense. It's in formal traditional terms, it's seeing through Atma, Atta, seeing through self, seeing through the idea that there is a permanent substrate underlying reality to ourselves, that somewhere inside me, so to speak, there is a something which is fixed and permanent, that is independent. This is what we subtly believe. We believe that the self exists independent of circumstances. And it's as if that the self consumes experience and itself remains free from experience, which of course is logically impossible. Do you see what I mean? So that we project into our experience an underlying self which is real and permanent and exists independently of the moment of experience. We also project a world out there that exists independently of the moment of experience. And experience is the coming together of the independent self and the independent world, somehow by logical twists that are impossible to fathom. Thirdly, we believe that the self we project onto our experience, a self that is self-generated, if you see what I mean. In traditional terms, it's spoken of as the author of itself. It exists inherently, and it sort of generates from itself. It's self-created and self-creating, because it exists independently of the experiencing moment. This is all very familiar, I'm sure. Should be. But it doesn't exist. It really isn't there. Of course, there is experience, and there is, if you like, an empirical experience of self as a centre of action and a centre of experience. But it doesn't exist independent of experience. And it is itself part of a chain of conditions. It comes about independent of conditions and forms conditions out of which new empirical self arises. And all our suffering, of course, according to the Buddhadhamma, comes from our failure to recognize that this imputed self, this Atman, Atta, just isn't real. We don't need it, actually. It's merely a sort of logical convenience to say I, because it helps to get breakfast and have a conversation. But it has no reference to anything that you can ever experience. And the crucial significance of spiritual death, of getting rid of this fixed, independent, self-authored self, is that it stands in the way of the Bodhisattva. Because we cling to an independent selfhood, because we believe firmly that such a thing exists without even knowing that we believe it. We believe it below the level of thought, even. It's built into experience. It's what a term I've been using, borrowing from Schopenhauer, which I think is extremely useful. It's part of the original disposition of the mind. The mind comes ready structured in terms of an independent self in an independent world. That's the way it's served up to us. It's not a question of just listening to a talk and thinking, oh yeah, I'll stop doing that. It's not that easy. If only. Nobody's saying that. It stands in the way of us being selfless, because we build all our clinging around that imputed self. Our animal instincts of craving, our animal instincts of fight and flight and so forth, all get tied up with the survival of that fixed imputed self. And that prevents us from entering the stream of the Dhamma, from entering the bodhisattva life, if you like, from becoming the bodhisattva, or becoming part of the bodhisattva, to put it that way, to be motivated by the bodhicitta. The clinging to self stands in the way of that. We have glimpses, don't we, sometimes, of something that's beyond ourselves. We even function sometimes in that way. We transcend ourselves to some degree. But then self even takes hold of that. You start saying, I'm doing really well spiritually. I'm being really selfless. And that, of course, brings self back. It's so deeply buried in. I don't think we really realise this. Sometimes when people talk about insight and selflessness and so forth, it seems as if it's a merely cognitive thing. In a way, it is cognitive, but it's cognitive at a pre-intellectual level, if you see what I mean. It functions beneath the level of our conscious thought. So we can quite easily have a complete intellectual assent to the fact that there cannot be an independent self, and act thoroughly selfishly. If you don't believe me, I can prove it. No, I prove it every day. And I'm sure you do too. I'm not trying to insult you or anything like that. And if you are insulted, then that's your problem. I'll come to that later. Being insulted is a very, very good practice, but we'll come to that later. So if you want to approach the bodhisattva, if you want to approach the bodhisattva as a goal that then, as it were, opens out into Buddhahood itself, one of the things you need to do, and it's only one of the things, is to weaken and even eradicate that strong attachment to a self, an independent, what did I say? Independent, permanent, and self-authored self. You need to get rid of that. Problem is that it's easy to talk about, and you know, in a scientific age, it's relatively easy to understand at a superficial level. I think probably many aspects of modern psychology, neurology, and so forth reveal to us very clearly that there is no fixed permanent self. But the gap between that mere intellectual assent, that theoretical assent, and an actual recognition and dropping self is quite large. Huge. Well, vast. Completely different thing. So what I want to do today is to look at three ways in which we can work on this. It's not definitive, because I think that sort of passing beyond self-clinging happens in very, very different ways for different people. I think some people just pass beyond it without even trying. I don't know why, I don't know how. I'm always delighted reading William James' Varieties of Mystical Experience. It's a wonderful account of a Yorkshire policeman who walks home from the station house, and there's probably not a lot of crime in Yorkshire in the late 19th century, walks home from the station house across the moors, and then he describes an experience which is clearly, at the very least, an extremely exalted sort of samadhi. He speaks of it in terms of really recognising he's not there and becoming part of everything. And he has apparently no religious background, apparently not a thinker, just in a way a very good man who, for various reasons, under certain momenti and who knows what happened in the past, just seems to have dropped it, whether permanently or not, it's hard to say because it's just a bare account. But I don't think we should think of it as something that's to be artificially done. We may have to ourselves put some effort into it, but it can come about by quite chance and circumstantial ways, simply being in touch with people who are relatively selfless. You just begin to sort of see things from their point of view. You know, to what extent it's hard to say, but I've certainly felt that with my contact with Sangharakshita, that he's certainly a great deal more selfless in his experience than I am. And being with him, I'm been forced back on my awareness of my own petty selfishness and pulled a little bit beyond that. So, you know, I don't want to prescribe how this happens. I think there are all sorts of ways. Simple reading of a book. Jnanavacha and I went to see a performance of As You Like It, and I want to take this occasion to warn you against it. It's terribly poor. But Shakespeare somehow or other usually manages to survive. I've only seen him downed finally and completely once. Birmingham rep, but Shakespeare just didn't survive. But last night, bits of Shakespeare come through, and you remember All the World's a Stage and etc. And the Seven Ages of Man, Jaques, the melancholic Jaques, and it's a reflection on the way in which we pass through identities, and those identities ultimately dissolve. So it's perfectly possible that reading that or listening to that or a song even sometimes can hit a certain note which just wakes you up. It's not sort of a Buddhist property, if you see what I mean. It doesn't belong to Buddhism. Buddhism is simply an especially clear and pure way of understanding what that's about, and of providing methods for doing so. I want to suggest at least three aspects, three ways of practicing that I personally have found very helpful and that have been sort of in the background and formed my own attempts to enter the Bodhisattva life. To what extent, it's not for me to say. That I offer to you as maybe something that you can reflect on that may spark you off in your own life to practice in your own way. Doesn't matter how you do it, if you see what I mean. Techniques, it's not about technique. In the end, it's sort of more like art when you suddenly, in engaging with art in any way, you suddenly enter the zone of the piece, if you see what I mean, when you're looking at a painting and you suddenly enter its zone. Do you know what I mean? Borrowing a term from Tarkovsky. Or when you're watching a film and suddenly you realise that you've crossed a sort of threshold and that you're no longer sitting back observing it, wondering who that actor is and where did you see them before and, oh, that's better than the last film. You're suddenly absorbed in the film. So, yes, there's a sort of threshold to be crossed, which is more of the nature of an aesthetic threshold than a technical one. Sometimes people talk about spiritual death in such technical terms. Maybe it works for them. It turns me off, frankly. I think that it's more likely to be experienced as a sort of, a kind of aesthetic. It's aesthetic on the highest and most refined and most subtle level. So I'm going to tell you now what those three ways of approaching are, and then we'll have a tea break, and we'll start to look at them. So I'll lay out the menu, and if you don't like the meal, I'm sure you've got something better to do. You could go and put on a witch's hat and dress as a zombie. It's very interesting, that acting out, isn't it? Because, in a way, when you put on clothes, you enter into something. It's a ritual. That's what I really saw last night. People were ritually enacting death and taking on the dreadful, as it were, and inserting themselves, so to speak, into it. They're very interesting in the Tibetan Bardo Todol tradition, the so-called Book of the Dead tradition. There are some texts, which I've never actually seen, but I've seen referred to as the liberation through wearing. So presumably what they are is to do with putting upon the corpse various amulets and maybe even dress, I don't know, that evoke the experience of liberation. Anyway, back to what was I going to say before I so rudely interrupted myself? The three methods. So the first... God, I'm really taken to this idea of dressing up. The first method is a classic one, and I think very important to get a grasp on, but I hope I might be able to bring a bit of fresh understanding to it, and that's the so-called three prajñas, suttamayi prajña, or shrutamayi prajña, suttamayi panya, chintamayi prajna and bhavanamayi prajna. The wisdom that comes from listening, sutta, sunta is the modern Hindi for to listen, chintamayi prajna, which is the liberation, the wisdom that comes from reflection or thinking, chintati is still, chintna means, it's thinking, yeah. Reflection. And bhavana means developing, sometimes called meditating. But I'm going to give a slightly different interpretation of that. It's, I think, probably... I'm not going to say what it is now, because then you won't have to come back, and you can go off and dress as zombies. That's the first, the three prajñas. I'm going to look at that, because I think that's pretty basic. And you need to understand what you're doing in that area. And everybody should be engaging with that on one level or another. And certainly by the time you're ordained, you should be engaging with it at the third level. The second method is what I call reaction practice. Now, you might think I don't need any practice at reacting. I'm quite good at it already. But what I mean is using reaction as a practice. Instead of merely regretting it, which, of course, you have to do, reflecting upon it, using it as a point of reflection, and ultimately as a liberating point of reflection. I think, for me, it's been the most powerful practice I've ever done. And other people, the more annoying they are, the better teachers they are. Damn them. This is Shanti Deva, isn't it? That your best friend is actually your worst enemy, because, well, I'm now giving my gold away again. Thirdly, there's nothing practice. Nothing practice. This is actually the hardest practice, but again, one that I think it's important that everybody engages with to some degree within their lives from the start, and becomes more and more adept at being nothing, doing nothing, going nowhere, having nothing, grasping nothing, just nothing, nothing practice. Solitary retreats are very good in this way if you don't make a heavy schedule for yourself and do a, you know, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2 sort of solitary retreat. I've done plenty of those. So I'm going to look at these three. I'll make up my mind what order I'll deal with them when you come back. I'll look at you and I'll know. I'll probably deal with the three pragnas first because it sort of forms the background to the other two. But we'll try to understand fully what these three are, and I hope that in understanding them, you'll be sort of doing them. I think this kind of Dhamma discussion, if it works, is never just theoretical, if you're at all open. I'm sure you are. You're also working it back into yourself as I'm speaking. I think my strongest experiences of understanding the Dhamma have been listening to Bhante, being in a seminar with him, listening to a talk, and just opening myself to what he's saying and engaging, of course, as sharply and clearly as I can with my intellect. But at times, through just listening to him, I've had my deepest understandings of the nature of things. I think Dharma study, listening to talks, if they're well done, you can tell me later, is actually practice. So I hope that in going through these three practices, you'll be doing them. And I hope that through going through them, you'll be able to see how they might work in your own life. You're you, you're not me. So it'll work differently for you. But they may be more present in your life than you realise. They're not the only thing. For instance, I'm not going to talk about intense faith, which I think can be transcending. I think if you really give yourself to the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas, and you really know what you're giving yourself to, well, you give yourself. You give up yourself fully. I'm not going to talk about that, but probably. So let's have some tea. How long should I give you?
20 minutes.
20 minutes.